So, yes, as everybody said, we've reached Luke chapter 8, and I'm going to be sharing on that and sowing a little bit about the Romania trip in between as well. So, most of you are probably familiar with what goes on in Luke chapter 8. We have the little bit that Christine read to us about a light being under a bushel, and we've also got the parable of the sower. And we've got how Jesus healed the man called Legion, the demoniac, and then how he healed the woman with the issue of blood, and finally Jairus, his daughter, who died. At the first bit of Luke, chapter 8, it says about how he was going about through cities and towns preaching the word. And it says that the disciples went with him, but also there were women, and they went following him as well. And what was their reason? And it says there they wanted to provide for Jesus' needs, and so they did so out of their own pocket. So there were these women following Jesus, providing out of their own pocket. They'd seen something in Jesus that wanted them to find a way to serve him. And today, we might not have a way of being able to provide for Jesus' own physical needs. He doesn't need us to provide for his own physical needs anymore. But those of you who gave to the Romania Love Offering, we're doing it for him, just as those of you who are doing cap hampers or any of the other acts of service that you're doing it for Jesus. And then following on from this, Jesus tells the crowd the parable of the sower. And I'm sure you're all familiar with it, that the seed fell on different sorts of ground. And the birds ate it, it grew up, and the sun shriveled it, and all the other things. And Jesus had a hidden meaning, but the people would have known the story about the sower and what he meant by that. They might not have known the hidden meaning, but in the Old Testament times, the farmer would have walked along a path with a basket of seed or a bag slung over his shoulder, and he would have just thrown the seed and it would have landed where it landed. So it wouldn't have been carefully done like perhaps modern farmers do it in order to save every single bit of seed they possibly can. He would know that not all of it would reach maturity. As Christians, we're sowers of seed. Are we concerned about the cost of seed going to waste? Or are you like the farmer walking along, just sowing your seed and not knowing where it will come up? 1 Corinthians 3:6-9, Paul says, "I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God has been making it grow. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. The one who plants and the one who waters have one purpose, and they will each be rewarded according to their own labor, for we are co-workers in God's service. You are God's field, God's building." So therefore, our job is to ensure that the seed is sown, not where it lands. We might not be the ones who water it. That might be someone else's job. But what our job is to sow the seed. Whatever the stage the seed is at, we have to believe that by faith, God will give the increase. So are you very careful how you sow your seed? Or don't you care where it goes? You should be someone who doesn't care where your seed lands, as long as you're sowing the seed, because it might grow, but you might not see it. Someone else might be watering it, and then it will grow. If you don't throw the seed, it won't have an opportunity to grow. So we're going to move on a little bit towards the Romania love offering and what we did with it. This was to provide very poor people with groceries, and that's what was put in each bag. These people can be hospice patients, gypsies, or others on very low or non-existent incomes. And they receive these bags in many different ways, just like the seed that was sown in the ground. Some are very matter-of-fact. Some are very grateful. Some even want to give us something as a way of saying thank you, even though they don't have anything to give. And some cry. This year, we filled 280 large carrier bags with groceries for hospice patients and 100 bags for families who are served by Aurora Christian Association. There are some of the bags. All the piles of food are the ones that we packed for Aurora. The other bags are the ones at the hospice waiting to go out. Now, some of you who have got very, very good memories might think, well, you said 280 bags. I'm sure it was 300 and something last year. And you're right, it was. Now, this isn't because the need isn't so great and people are better off. It's because the hospice, being a charity, is having a little bit of a struggle with their finances at the moment. And so they've decided, rather sadly, that they've got to cut back on the number of patients that they are treating. So instead of treating patients from the towns and villages around Brasov, they're now only going to concentrate on adults in the city. So if they're taking on more, they'll only take on new ones who actually live in Brasov. The children, they will continue to treat wherever. So that's why we did 280 and not 300 and something. But we still did Christmas gifts for the children, which we all wrapped. I can't remember exactly how many. I think it was 250, but I might be wrong because I can't remember exactly. But we sat every evening packing those bags for the children, and they'll get them those at their Christmas party. So once we filled the bags at the hospice, we get to go out with the social work team to deliver some of them. And occasionally, one might understand a little bit of English, but on the most part, our language separates us, so we don't have much opportunity to communicate our faith to them. But we take encouragement from Matthew 25, and I'll just read that to you. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did it for me." So that's our basis of going out and giving these bags of food to people. But we still want them to know that it's not just a group of four ladies coming from the UK because we want to bless them for whatever reason, just we're do-gooders, we feel sorry for them, whatever. We don't want them to think that. We want them to know that that bag of groceries is a gift from God, not from us. And so we do a little leaflet. Oops, it's not... No, I've lost it. There it is. There's a little leaflet which goes into each bag. And that leaflet says that this gift is from South Kent Community Church to show them God's love in a practical way. And at the bottom it says, Jesus te beshte, which means Jesus loves you. And on the back of that sheet are some Bible verses which we hope will be of help to them. Perhaps a 23rd Psalm one year we put on there, or God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in time of trouble, that sort of thing. So that they have something we can tell them about God, even though we can't say so in language. Now, like the farmer who sowed the seed, we don't know what the outcome will be with those leaflets. We don't know whether they'll be read, and if they are read, what the response will be. And I think a couple of years ago I gave a testimony about how I got very discouraged about these little leaflets, and I thought to myself, why do we bother to put them in? People will probably just screw them up and throw them away. And I got quite discouraged, and the enemy really sort of kept whispering in my ear, why do you bother doing it? Why don't you just give them the bags without the leaflets and save on the printing and all the other things? You might just as well do that. And that year, I didn't bother to change the Bible verses. They were the same ones from the year before. And God really spoke to me about this, because one of the people that we visited, an old lady, as soon as she saw me, she got out the sheet from the year before and she said, I read this every day. And I felt awful because she was going to be given the same verses, although it's good to read the same verses. So the next year, I did some new ones. But it wasn't just the one lady, there was another lady who said, oh yes, I read it every morning before I get up. And she went off to her bedroom and she brought out the sheet. And this year I did some new verses again. And we actually visited one of those old ladies. And guess what? She produced last year's sheet as well as the year before's and the year before that. And she said, I read them all the time. So we see that God moves and builds our faith, and it's an encouragement to plant your seed carelessly, because God is the one that brings the increase. Then we move on, and in verse 22 of Luke chapter 8 we see Jesus going across the lake. He was the one that suggested it. And he must have been very tired. All those people that he'd been ministering to, and as well as being God, he was also human. And he was tired, and he went to sleep in the boat. And, you know, the storm came up, and it was a really, really fierce storm. And you think that most of the disciples were fishermen. They'd been out on that lake. They must have been out in storms. They must have known what to do. And yet, went and woke Jesus up. Why did they wake him up? Was it because they needed all hands on deck to help with the storm? Was it because they were so afraid that they were going to drown that they needed to wake Jesus so that he was ready for when the boat went down as well with them and not sleeping and drowning? But Jesus rebukes the elements, and then when the calm comes, he also gently rebukes the disciples as well. And then in fear and amazement, they ask one another, who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. Now, to me, that seemed quite a strange question for them to ask, because they'd been with Jesus. They'd seen him perform all sorts of miracles. So why were they surprised when he calmed the storm? But we see God move, don't we? And it builds our faith. And yet sometimes, when something else happens, we're so focused on the problem that we forget what went on before. And when Jesus does intervene, we're surprised all over again. I have an example of this. In the early 80s, when a lot of you possibly weren't part of this church, we were meeting in a little mission building at Aldington. And we were growing, and we were getting bigger and bigger, and the elders and the leaders felt it was time to move to somewhere else. And those of you who have been on that journey know that over the years, there have been a number of possible buildings that we thought might be the one for us, and each time, the door's been shut. For me personally, and perhaps for some of you, that's made it harder and harder to believe that we'll ever get a building. Because every time the door was shut, you know, you say, oh, this must be the one. This is great. And then, nope. And then when the next one comes up, you think, yes, well, I wonder, perhaps it's not. And then you hear stories about other people who get churches. I heard of one, I think it was in Australia, where someone, I think the leader had to pay a penny or something ridiculous like that for this wonderful church building. And you think, isn't God amazing? He does that for people. But you think, well, that's in Australia, or that's up north, or that's somewhere where there's lots of land. Down here in Kent, there's nothing. We probably, if we had the money to buy the land, we probably wouldn't get planning permission. If we had money to buy a building, we probably wouldn't be able to. You know, there's all sorts of things that you start to think. And yet, where are we now? As Nigel said about the wow factor, God did do it. And what's more, because for many of us it probably seemed impossible, we can rejoice all the more because we can see how great and powerful God is. But what about the next time? Might not be a church building that time. It might be something else. What about when we face another situation? Will we remember God? Remember this time and trust God? Or will we panic, like the disciples did in the boat, and wake Jesus up and say, we're going to die? And then he comes to their rescue anyway, even though their faith, well, at that moment, their faith was non-existent, wasn't it? But he still came to their rescue. Then, following the storm, Jesus heals the man called Legion and sets him free from his torment. And he puts all the evil spirits, he tells them to go into a herd of pigs. And the herd of pigs run down and jump off the cliff. And the people are so frightened that they ask Jesus to leave. And understandably, the man wants to go with Jesus. I think I'd want to go with Jesus if he'd done something so marvellous for me. But what does Jesus do? He tells him to stay where he is and tell those with whom he's living what wonderful things God has done. And I was thinking about that and thinking that sometimes we hear of people doing things for the Lord in other countries, or, you know, great sort of things that you think, well, what we do is very insignificant compared to that. But the important thing is to know that we're where Jesus wants us to be, whether that's staying at home or going somewhere else, because that's where we'll be serving him the best, because that's where he wants us to be. And we can take comfort in that, as long as we know that that's where God wants us to be. We don't need to worry what X is doing over there or what Y is doing over there, as long as we're doing what Jesus is asking us to do. Then things move on. And Jairus comes to him because his daughter is dying. Now Jairus is a leader in the synagogue. He held a position of power and respect and probably would have been richer than a lot of the other people as well. And Jesus goes with him, not because of his wealth or his position, but because of his need. And then I'm sure you're familiar with all the crowds gathering round him, including a woman who was an outcast. Now this woman had been bleeding for 12 years and she'd spent everything she got trying to find a cure. But she still was no better. Now, in biblical times, when a woman had her monthly period, she was considered unclean for 7 days. And anything she touched in that time was also considered unclean. So for those 7 days, she would have been quite isolated. And you can read about that in Leviticus 15, verse 25. Just think about it. This woman had not been isolated for 7 days every month. She had been isolated every day for 12 years. Not just that, she probably had other problems relating to that fact. She might well have been anemic and other things. She would have felt unwanted, rejected, dirty, and lonely. She must have been really desperate to risk touching someone and making them unclean too. I suspect she hoped no one would notice because of all the masses of people around. She had nothing to lose by touching Jesus, but Jesus lost something when she touched him. Power went from him. And he knew that someone had been healed. Someone had deliberately touched him by faith. And he wanted to single them out and commend them, even though it took up time when he was supposed to be going somewhere else in a hurry. Jesus has time for everyone who comes to him. When we might feel that no one cares or seems to notice how badly things are going for us, we can reach out in our weakness. Even if we feel we can only manage to just touch the very edge of his garment, he will know and he will meet us. Now, the world has moved on. And in most cultures, women aren't considered unclean every month. But sadly, the world can still be a very difficult place for people to live in, especially when they are poor. And in Romania, the gypsy community and the very poor Romanians still struggle with the day-to-day living, especially as many are still illiterate or very poorly educated. And one of ACA's, that's Aurora Christian Association, who we work with, one of their main aims is to work to try and encourage the children to go to school so they can have a better chance of breaking the poverty circle they are in. In the area of Volcan, where we work, things have slightly improved. For a number of the gypsies, they now have jobs in factories because the government are having a drive to get people into work. However, there's still many others who are not employed. And we encountered some very sad situations this year. And for many years, we visited a lady called Anchor. Now, quite some time ago, we visited her when her children were very tiny. And at that time, she had lost her husband. And that Romanians have to have an identity card in order to be able to claim benefits and work and do all sorts of things that we take for granted being able to do. And a lot of the Romanians don't get identity cards. And the problem is that once they haven't got one, which you're supposed to get when your child is born, once they haven't got one, they get fined for not having one. So when they go to apply for one, they've got to pay fines before they can actually get one. So it's not very easy. And when we were visiting Anchor, when her children were little, we actually helped to pay her fine so that she could get an identity card and get child benefit. Anchor met someone else, and now she's got a little boy. Her son, Sammy, her second son, he has got very bad epilepsy, and it's quite hard for someone like Anchor to deal with that. So Irene, the English lady who works for ACA, is trying to help Anchor to get the assistance she needs to help with Sammy. Now, Sammy has an older brother, David. He must be, I think he's about 16. And not that long ago, David was diagnosed with an incurable brain tumour. And we went to visit them in their tiny little house up in the Gypsy Village. And this tumour is obviously pressing on the optic nerve, so he now can't see. And he spends all day in this tiny little room sitting on a sofa. And that was a very difficult experience for us to see David like that. And when we said goodbye to Anchor and she cried, she made me cry because I gave her a hug, and then she burst into tears and she cried and cried because she doesn't know what to do with David. And Irene wants to help. And David has got to have an MRI and some other investigations to see how much the tumour has grown. Now, if he goes as an outpatient, his mum has to pay £50 for the MRI. So Irene said that if she got the paperwork, then she would use some of the money that you gave to pay for the MRI. But she does have to have the paperwork because she wants to make sure that Anchor uses the money for the right purpose. But she's just emailed me and told me that Anchor still hasn't brought her the paperwork. And that's not unusual for gypsies because they're very all over the place. But she's going to, Irene is going to try and see if they will admit David for a couple of days so he can then get the MRI free rather than having to pay for it. James 1:27 says, true spirituality that is pure in the eyes of our Father God is to make a difference in the lives of the orphans and widows in their troubles and to refuse to be corrupted by the world's values. And this year, it was very sad because we met at least three women who have been widowed actually just in this year. And that lady is called Lumi, and she lives up in the Gypsy Village. We met her last year, and we gave her a cardigan for that little girl, her youngest daughter, that an old lady, a friend of Ruth Ridgewell's, had knitted, and so we were able to take a photo of the little girl in the cardigan so Ruth could give the old lady the picture. And at that time, Lumi's husband was there, and he had his arm in a sling. And they said he'd broken it. And they even showed us the x-rays. Not that that meant anything to us, of course. But unfortunately, he hadn't got a broken arm. He'd got a tumour that went undiagnosed until this spring. And this spring, he sadly died very quickly after a proper diagnosis. So that Lumi was the first person we visited who'd lost her husband this year. Last year, ACA built two extra rooms on their tiny little house. You go up to the gypsy village, you talk about houses. They're not really houses, they're just like sheds, really. And when you say built two rooms, they're sort of quite easy in one sense to build, because it's not like building a couple of rooms onto your house here. And they built these two rooms for Lumi because she's got so many children. But the children are now, that her husband's gone, running rings round her. And her two eldest sons, who I think are in their late teens, possibly early 20s, have decided that these two extra rooms are for them. So they've each claimed one of the rooms, which means that Lumi and all her other children are all sleeping in one small room. And the young lady that you can see behind Lumi, she's her daughter, she's 15. She ran away with her boyfriend just before her dad died. She's now come back, and Lumi and her mother-in-law both think that she is pregnant, although she denies it. Obviously, time will tell. But Irene wants to help Lumi with her children and try to get some order back, and perhaps to get the two oldest sons to perhaps be willing to just share a room rather than everybody else having to sleep together on a sofa. Wouldn't be a bad idea, would it? Then there was Lumi's mother-in-law. I don't have a picture of her. I'm afraid I cut her head off. So, now, we were a bit shocked about Lumi's mother-in-law, because she was there with Lumi, and she was the same age as Julie Bowman. We all thought she must be at least 80. She looked so old that she'd lost her son, one of her brothers, and who was an alcoholic, and the other brother, who is also an alcoholic, went to pieces, and they found him in the road. They don't know whether he had a fall or whether he'd been beaten up. And she's convinced that he's dying, and she looks after him, but she won't let him do anything because he's dying. But Irene didn't think he was dying, but he does need some help. So that's another job for Irene. Then we met Lella. Now, those of you who've been to Romania will know Lella, because she helps in the kindergarten. Lella's husband decided that their two little rooms were too small. So he went to the bank and he borrowed some money and he started building a bigger house for them. Then he lost his job. So he decided, like a lot of Romanians do, that he would go abroad to get some money. And he went to the Netherlands. Lella didn't want him to go, but he said he must. So off he went. And he wasn't feeling 100% when he went, but he went anyway. And one day he telephoned her and he said, "I don't feel very well." So she said, "Why don't you come home? Please come home." The next thing is that there's a telephone from a Dutch hospital to say that he died. He had pneumonia and he was working in the fields. So this means that poor Lella is left with her children on her own, without her husband. She had to go through an awful lot of paperwork in order just to get him home. But now she has no money. So ACA are helping her to do all the necessary paperwork to get a widow's pension, as such as it is. It's not very much, but it would be better than nothing. And she also needs to find out whether she is now liable for the money that her husband borrowed from the bank. So it would be really good if you could pray for Lella. A couple from Norway who we've met on previous trips are actually provided the money to help to complete the house, which is wonderful for Lella. But what was really lovely was, I thought it was lovely anyways, that Lella's little girl, Teo, is just a bit younger than Lorelei. And Fiona had given me that coat that Lorelei had grown out of. And I gave it to Irene, and she said, Teo would love that coat. And so we gave it to Teo. And I thought that was really lovely, that one widow with a little girl in the UK would bless another little widow with a little girl in Romania. And I thought that was a really lovely thing to have happened. So much hardness, hardship, and so much sadness. It's really, you know, quite moving when you're there. ACA wants to do more to support widows and the elderly, especially those living alone. And Irene has now got two other people helping her from the UK, as well as the actual Romanian workers in ACA, Amy and Joe. Joe's back in the UK at the moment. But Amy has married a Romanian and so is living in the village. And she has a car, so she's been going out into the more remote areas and finding people in terrible distress. And Eileen and I went to visit two families. One is a family with lots of children who was really struggling. They were Romanian, not gypsies. And the other ones were Hungarians. I can't go into it now, but there are a lot of Hungarians living in Romania for historical reasons. Now, this lady, we didn't meet her because she was out when we took the bags. We saw her daughter. She lives in that shack in the corner there, and that caravan, which looks quite okay in that picture, but it isn't. It's a really horrible old caravan. She has lots of children. Now, the concrete bit on the front is the base for a home. And her husband built that base. But he was so discouraged by everything that was going wrong in their lives and how they were living. He got depressed. And sadly, in the spring, he hung himself in that little shack. So now she's all on her own. And Irene is very keen to help that lady. We gave her some bags of food, I hasten to add, to help that lady to complete all the paperwork that she needs to do in order to be able to continue with the building. And in the spring, because you can't really build in the winter there, Irene's hoping that they might be able to get some support to build her a house for the children to live in. That's just a few of the people that we've been dealing with in this visit that wouldn't have been blessed if it hadn't been for all of you. And on the day we left, the snow started, so this makes life even more difficult for them. So you might think a bag of food isn't going to do very much, but it really does bless them. And also, we left some money with Irene so that she can buy more food over the weeks and months ahead. So, if we go back to Luke 8, coming towards the end now. Jesus stopped to talk to the woman. He wanted to commend her for her faith. And while he was doing that, someone came and told him that it's too late, the little girl's died, might as well not bother going. But Jesus still goes, and with her parents watching, raises her from the dead because of her father's faith. It's interesting to note that the little girl was 12 years old, and the woman who had her ailment had had it for 12 years. It's just an interesting little twist there. That Jesus is no respecter of persons, rich or poor, old or young, sick or well. He treats people from all different walks of life exactly the same. Although he does have a special place in his heart for widows, orphans and the downtrodden. Jairus was a leader in the synagogue, and the bleeding woman was an outcast. But Jesus graciously met their respective needs and responded to their faith with equal love, power and willingness to heal. It says in Job, "He shows no partiality to princes and does not favour the rich over the poor, for they are all the work of his hands." This is the God we serve. We are called to be like him. I know I still have a long way to go. What about you?